Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And last week we talked about X events or extreme events that radically impact the world we live in, like the financial crisis or Hurricane Katrina. My next guest looks at why some systems, communities, and even ecosystems survive and bounce back in the face of such devastation, while others do not. Andrew Zolli, curator of the Global Innovation Network PopTech, and the co-author now of Resilience, Why Things Bounce Back, joins us. Welcome to WNYC.
Thanks, Brian. It's great to be here.
First, let's define the word resilience.
Well, one of the challenges in defining it is that lots of different people use it in different ways. So biologists mean it in one way, and economists mean it in another, and social scientists mean it in yet a third. All of the definitions share one of two principles. They either refer to the ability to maintain a system, a person, an organization in the face of change, or to bounce back from disruption. So that combination of either continuity or recovery, the way we define it in the book and in all of our work, is around the ability of an organization, a system, an individual, a community to thrive and survive amid the widest variety of circumstances and disruptions.
So let's take an example. And I see you just came back from a major resilience conference. Yes, folks, they hold resilience conferences. And where? Iceland, which was perhaps the hardest hit country during the 2008 financial crisis.
That's right, actually. It was the site of the largest per capita financial calamity in history. Because of the overinflation of the banks and then the calamity, the Icelandic stock market went from 9,000 to 14.
Yikes.
So this was a huge, massive disruption. But today, less than 4 years later, Iceland's economy is growing. Their unemployment rate is lower than the United States. There are lots of different reasons. Their path out of the crisis looked radically different than the one that we took in the U.S.
How so, and how in a way that gets at this idea of what makes a resilient institution?
Well, a big part of it is they actually let failure happen. And one of the paradoxes of resilient systems is that you actually have to let them fail so that they learn.
Didn't bail out the banks, in other words?
They voted twice not to bail out their banks. They decided to hold a popular referendum. They decided that by popular referendum. They then decided to rewrite their constitution from scratch and criminally indict their former prime minister and a number of the bankers who were responsible for the calamity.
Wow.
And so you're talking about basically restructuring the system. But they had a couple of things going for them that were really extraordinary. The country generates almost all of its electricity from geothermal energy. So it has a huge clean tech economy. It has a booming tourism industry. It has a diversified, you know, one of the best music scenes in the world. I don't understand how a place that's smaller than Worcester, Massachusetts generates Bjork and Sigur Rós and all the rest of them. But there's a thriving creative economy. And it's that diversity that enabled the system to rebound, and a sense that everybody was put by those acts of popular referendum in the same boat.
We should say that resiliency isn't just found in systems we admire, but sometimes in systems we loathe. So you cite terror networks like Al-Qaeda or harmful resilient diseases like tuberculosis.
Yeah, and in fact, actually, the fascinating thing is that those kinds of systems often use the same strategies, even though they look radically different. If you think about Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, as an example, which is today one of the thriving centers for Al-Qaeda in the world, you know, for long periods of time, terrorists look exactly like everybody else. They don't actually do very much. That's why they're hard to detect. You have to basically detect an intent in someone's mind. And then eventually, after a period of long dormancy, they have to pop up and basically advertise their potency so that they can spread. Well, that is very similar to the strategy that tuberculosis follows in your body. For long periods of time, TB, which affects one in three people on Earth, basically sits dormant, almost metabolically inert for long periods of time until a tipping point is reached in a weakened immune system, and then it pops up and sort of explodes all over the place. In fact, interestingly, more virulent diseases like Ebola don't happen all that frequently on Earth, primarily because they kill everybody so quickly. The thing about TB is that they actually have these long periods, and they let what they do is they let the next generation of human beings grow up so they have a host to grow into.
So do you have an opinion about the climate in this respect? Because when you talk about climate change and what policies humans should enact to deal with it, there are those who say, oh, my God, the climate's going to fall apart. The Earth's going to fall apart. And there are those who say, oh, no, you're being chicken littles. Look how resilient history has shown planet Earth to be.
Well, right now in the climate debate's a perfect example of a big structural shift that we're seeing, a shift away from traditional models and frameworks of sustainability and toward models that are focused on greater resilience. And the metaphor that we use is one of a car. So imagine we take all the people who care about this issue or any big global catastrophic issue, we put them in a car and we send them toward a cliff of irrevocable change. Now, when the car is far from the cliff, the people who have the moral authority in the car are saying things like, stop, turn around, hit the brakes, come into some equilibrium with the cliff because we are going over. They say things like, don't build another coal-fired power plant. And that is the right and moral and proper thing to say. But as the car gets closer to the cliff, because profits are rarely appreciated in their own time, and because paradoxically, just because the car is far from the cliff, it continues in this direction. And as it gets closer, the people who are in the car who now come to moral authority say something else. As the car comes to a point where even hitting the brakes it might go over, a different group of people come to the fore and they say things like, we had better put an airbag and some parachutes on this thing because it could go over at any moment and we had better protect the vulnerable people who are in the car. And that's the right thing to say at that moment. And the challenge is that we are in an age in which we are living closer and closer to the cliffs.
So that is to say adaptation policies rather than just talking about stopping the underlying warming.
That's right. You know, in areas like climate, the word adaptation for years was verboten. We can't say that because if we start to adapt to the system as it is, we are giving a pass to the oil companies and the polluters and the fill-in-the-blank
That's
villain
right.
of the moment.
The environmentalists hate to talk about adaptation.
Absolutely. But we are at a point now where it is becoming essentially a fait accompli. The issues of climate adaptation are becoming pressing present concerns, not future concerns.
Before you go, is there something about resiliency that people can learn from your book about themselves as individuals? You're mostly writing about systems, complex systems.
Right. Well, in fact, actually, what we try to talk about are basically the people who are talking about the systemic end of resilience and the social end of resilience. But right in the middle are people like you and me. And so in the book, we talk about what makes a resilient mind and what makes one person resilient or another person not. And in that argument, basically, there are many, many things that contribute to resilience. So your genes, your life history, your personal relationships, your social network, the strength of the institutions around you. But there are things we can do to bolster our personal resilience. And neuroscientists are now learning from the minds of meditating Buddhist monks how to take mindfulness techniques so that people in high-stress positions, first responders and active-duty military personnel, people who are emergency room physicians, can actually learn to better manage stressful events when they're in the presence of that stress so they don't have to deal with the post-trauma of PTSD.
Fascinating. Andrew Zolli is the co-author of the new book, Resilience, Why Things Bounce Back, which officially is released today. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks, Brian.